So I sat in one of the TV or radio courses and loved it, and enjoyed it far more than the law courses I was in, although there's a lot of similarities between law and journalism because of the research involved. A lot of people don't realize that a lawyer spends more time, of course, behind his desk than he ever would does in courtroom or she. And a journalist does the same thing. I had a guy one time ask me, he says, and this was after my career was nearly over, and I had developed some sort of a reputation that, who knows what that might be, but if there is a reputation. And he said, Stan, what do you do? He knew exactly what I did, because he watches TV and could see me every night. I said, well, I'm in television. Well, I know that, but what do you do? Well, I do these investigative consumer reports. No, I mean, you're only on the air for 2 minutes every night. What do you do all day? But so much like law, we spend an awful lot of time, most of our time, preparing, researching, interviewing, and so forth, before such a thing is ever on TV or on radio. So I chose broadcasting. There was a small campus radio station at the time that Creighton had. There was no TV station in those days. TV was, this would have been in the 60s, mid-60s, early 60s. And TV was brand new in those days, so I got a little exposure on the radio station. And that's how I got started.
Right. TV used to only be in black and white. What was it like when it changed to color?
Right. Well, television developed pretty quickly, and initially, of course, there wasn't even movie pictures. They used still pictures. That was prior to my time. When I got into it, well, TV was just beginning. When I graduated, I had a choice. I could go to be a news director of a station in North Dakota, Fargo, which was pretty neat for college graduate being offered that position. I had done some part-time work for the local radio, and ultimately full-time work while I was a student for a local radio station in Omaha. So I had some experience. Well, anyway, they offered me a job in Fargo, North Dakota as a news director, and that was really, really great for my ego. But there was also a TV, radio, FM station right there in Omaha. And they offered me a job as a cub reporter. And so I took that as a way to get into this new growing, it wasn't brand new, but growing TV part of it. So, and I'm glad I did. In those days, television news was more of a public service. It really wasn't a money maker like it is today. The FCC requires stations to do certain things, and some of that is public service. Well, news was public service. As time went on, stations realized, you know, we might be able to make money at this news business. And indeed they did. Lots of money as time went on. So I went with the TV, radio, FM combo operation, you know, right out of college. And I'm glad I did, or I'd probably still be in Fargo. No, I don't want to say anything bad about Fargo. It's not Fargo. But it's a little colder than it is here. Yeah.
Choice of only 3 or 4 TV stations per city, but now they can choose from hundreds. What impact
did
that have on the employees in the stations?
Well, television, of course, initially, I think here in Kansas City, WDAF was the first, and that was in the late 40s, early 50s, something like that. Then we grew to 3 stations, and then 4 or 5 when UHF stations were introduced. So the viewers had basically selection, limited selection. It was this one, this one, this one. The competition was intense among those stations, and it still is today. However, and the money was really starting to come in for news. stations were making lots and lots of money. Some people say, and I wasn't on the business side, but some people said we make 40 cents on every dollar. That's enormous profit. And most of that came from news. Today, those profits are way, way, way down. And that's because we now have selections of maybe 200 stations to pick from, with the introduction of cable and satellite. So the profits have come down, the staff sizes have come down, the workloads have increased, the salaries have decreased because they're not making the money that they used to make.
How has the style of news reporting changed over the years, such as mixing news and entertainment with editorializing, reports, expressions, voice tone, or story selection?
It's changed significantly. I don't know. My education was in journalism, and sometimes I wonder today whether they're still teaching that. Used to be the stations, when there were just a few of them, programmed to the entire audience, and were very careful about offending any one large segment of that audience. Excuse me. Today, with so many stations to choose from, the audiences have all become segmented. The stations that are appealing to different segments rather than the mass, still the mass media, no doubt about that, instead of the largest masses that we used to have, the masses that we had strong. I guess I want to say they don't mind offending today, some people, at least the cable channels, I'll put in that category. So you'll have the station that does what we consider leans toward the right, or the conservative, then you have the station that leans toward the left, or the liberal, then you have a religious station, you have a country station, you have all of these other things that appeal to different audiences. So that's what's going on today. Now the fact that I don't like it, I think as a viewer, it's a challenge for us. It's a challenge to be sure we get a broad exposure to issues and people rather than rely on this source or this source or this source. We've got, as consumers, we need to sample all of them. Don't get locked into, this is my channel or that's my channel, and that's all I'm going to watch, that's all I'm going to listen to. Because I think we'll be, with the editorializing that is done today, disguised as straight news. You got to do that. We just got to get exposure to all the sides of the issues. In talking to people, I say, what channel do you watch? Well, I watch this one all the time. Well, yeah. But I like the people, I like the opinions, usually it's the opinions. I like the slant, they call it. And it's very hard to convince them that they need to expose themselves to a broader base of opinions. I work on it, but I'm there.
Do you think this segmentation has something to do with the fairness doctrine that used to control how stations and networks reported much of those shows no longer is really in place?
The Fairness Doctrine was a federal mandate that the FCC imposed on all broadcasters. And that was, the theory is, and it still is true today, the broadcasters use public airwaves. They're owned by the public. And because of that, the government regulates those airwaves, make sure they're being used properly. Now we're not talking about cable, we're talking about over-the-air broadcasters. So the government decided, you guys are going to have to be fair in what you present to prevent, basically, what we're seeing today from cable. This station only does this, this station does that. It's not a fair, open discussion, dialogue, controversial issues. And that's what the Fairness Doctrine regulated, controversial issues. What are those issues today? Certainly abortion, gun control, and these are ones that were controversial back then. Religion. The theory was, if you're going to discuss those issues, and we want you to, the government said you're going to do it fairly. I didn't mean equal. I meant fair. So you could have two opinions this way and maybe one that way. Maybe that's fair. They will decide for us, the government. Since all these other stations have come on the market and you can now choose what opinion you want to hear, the government said the Fairness Doctrine is no longer needed. So today it's a drop. But who's the most fair? In my opinion, you didn't ask this, but it flows. Who's the most fair today? What they call, they being the cable industry, calls the traditional broadcasters. ABC, CBS, NBC are probably the most fair on the air or available through cable today. I'm not saying they're always fair, they're the most fair. And I think they still have some journalistic integrity and present issues there. Anyway, that's my opinion.
How about changes in racial and gender makeup of news presenters?
Used to be you never saw blacks on TV. I'm not sure about religious preferences in those days, because I've never noticed that. You didn't see Hispanics. You didn't see minorities. Today you do, and that's very good. So I remember in the days when I was community affairs director, which was one of the management on the management team, the NAACP, and I was friends with this people, the leader. She was a great gal. Boy, she was the thorn in the side of the broadcasters. All of us, all stations. And it wasn't just in our city, it was in every city. They wanted to see more minorities, in those days blacks, on the air, or in management positions, or on staff, anywhere. And there weren't that many. And boy, did they hammer. They were constantly hammering for more and more and more. Thankfully, those efforts worked. It's not the only reason they worked. Today we do have some diversity, but there was no diversity back then. And thankfully there is, to reflect. There's still a long way to go, in my opinion, but it does reflect what's going on in broadcasting today or on the air more of what society is than it used to be, for sure. Same thing with the sexual, the gender. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. We didn't have women on the air too much back then. Now we do, and that's good.
What worries you about the news information industry today in light of social media, conservative versus liberal broadcasts, and the decline in newspaper readership?
We've touched a lot on those topics. The social media thing is a whole new ballgame, and that's changing things rapidly. People aren't going to turn it. They're going to still turn the TVs on and get news and information, but they're first going to be notified of events through social media. I don't like it, because most of that, or so much of it, is not reliable. Far less reliable, in my opinion, than any of that are on our TV sets today. But that's where people are first getting their information. And society's going to have to adjust, and I'm not sure how we adjust, but again, rely on multiple sources. That's about it. Don't rely on any single source for your source of information. If you get a social media update, don't rely on it. Don't take it as gospel, because it most likely is not. And there'll be some flaw in that story. The old story goes that if you whisper in somebody's ear and work it down the line, by the time it gets to the end of the line, it's far different from where it started. That's true with social media.
Do you think that will affect the jobs in broadcasting?
Yes. Broadcasting, or the whole electronic industry, has changed so dramatically. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about film. Originally, it was still pictures, and then it was black and white, and movies, and then it was color, and then it was HD, and all of that's changed. It's all digital now, which was a huge change. This system we're using here doesn't use tape. It doesn't use film. It's a little tiny chip, and that's just, yeah, here. So the jobs, I think, in the future are going to be social media or some form of social media. It's all going to be miniaturized equipment, as it's becoming right now. So I think there will be a lot. While there's fewer jobs, in my opinion, that pay well in the traditional broadcast business, I think in the social media area, whether it's marketing or so-called news, whatever it is on social media, that's where a lot of jobs are going to
be. Kind of changing topics now. You used to drive news cruisers with sirens and blue lights, something that you don't really see anymore, and were issued press credentials by the chief of police. Do you have any interest in stories about that?
Yeah. The chief of police would give us a pass. In those days, it was Clarence Kelly, who later became the FBI director. I think I've still got that press pass. So it was signed by him and all that. And yes, the media locally, we had a little blue light on top of our news cruisers. We only had two or three news cruisers in those days. And we had a siren. We had to push that button on the dashboard to activate the siren and hold it in. And activate the blue light as we fly through the city, heading for an airplane crash or a fire or whatever, so we could get there. I remember the time we were going, there was a plane crash up north of the river, and we were on the plaza. And heard about it on the scanner. So we go flying through the plaza. This was in a snowstorm. And we're moving really quickly. And we hear on the scanner some policeman talking to his dispatcher, "Who's that crazy news guy going through here? I'm not even going to try to chase him." We still did have to obey the law, but sometimes we cheated just a little bit. And in those days, the police worked with you a lot. We're most cooperative in helping facilitate what you were doing. We don't do that anymore. And thankfully, we don't, because we weren't really trained to do that as drivers.
You also said something earlier, not in the interview, but to me, something about the civil rights riots. Do you have any interest in talking about that?
Well, something was said earlier before the session that reminded me of the riots, because I was one of the 60s, and I was still kind of a cub reporter when this city experienced the riots. These riots were spreading across the country from city to big city to big city, mostly racial riots, and mostly students, high school students, young people, and it was really getting dangerous. This city had fires set all over it. Gunfire, police officers, snipers trying to kill them, and firemen who answered alarm calls. And I remember it was a horrible time, just a horrible time. And you begin to wonder, and I've asked this question of myself several times since, as we go through these stages, I call it a stage in society, in American society, where you're really concerned about the future of the country. And you're wondering, how are we going to survive this? How's this going to end? How can we make peace and satisfy the needs of all the people that are demanding something? But we do. We evolve, and we did. I remember going to, during the riots, we were issued gas masks because the police were often using gas to... what's the word? What kind of gas is that? It's not tear gas. I'm sorry, I couldn't think of tear gas to disperse the crowds. So we were issued gas masks. They were old Army issued stuff from, I think, World War. Who knows what it was? Which war? But I'm not sure they were pretty effective. I never needed to use it. But anyway, we had our gas masks. We had our little sirens and our blue lights. And I'm rushing out to a school, one of the high schools in town. It was Paseo at the time. And the original Paseo. And students were just, they all left school and were rioting with smashing cars and causing a real mess. And so I got out of my news cruiser. In those days, we had a report because we were radio, TV, FM, all in one. So what do you do when you get to a fire or to a riot? Do you shoot pictures with your little handhelds or your movie camera? Still or silent a movie camera? Or do you report on the radio live at the station for your two-way radio? So it's always a choice. In case of a fire, you better get the pictures because the flames will go out. So in the case of the riot, I'm out of the car, next to the car, and I'm shooting with my little Bell & Hall movie camera, 16mm, and trying to report on the radio. And the mob found me, and others who were around us, throwing rocks, hit me, and several others hit the car and damaged it and whatnot. So I hopped back in the car and back out of there as far away as I could and continued to report from distance where it was safe. Scary times. And that was nothing compared to what was going on in the city. People were being killed. Cops were being killed. Firemen were being killed. But anyway, the later principal had learned about this. We must have reported it on the radio or on TV. Principal wrote me a letter and called me, apologizing for the behavior of the students. And I later met with him. Nice guy. That was nice. But no harm done. I mean, I wasn't hurt physically. And we went along. Fortunately, the riots gradually were quelled. You know, we talked about going from film to the change, which since we went to digital, is just dramatic. Originally, I would shoot a handheld Bell & Howell 16mm movie camera. We could do that as reporters, but we could not shoot the sound cameras. That took a little more professional help, and so we had a cameraman that just did the sound movie cameras on tripods, big tripods. Took forever to set them up with all the lighting and whatnot that was required. And with film, first black and white and then color, you really have to manage your time because it's expensive. When you do an interview with somebody, be sure you have your questions ready to go. And you can get the answers you want because if you use a lot of film reels, the boss is going to call you in the office and have you on the carpet. Excuse me. With tape, when we went to videotape, first it was 2 inches wide, the videotape. Those won't make very portable recorders. So, we would bring film back to the station, convert it in the station, in the studio, to the tape, the videotape, which we would then play on the air. Initially, we didn't have videotape, we had to play the film on the air, which is projectors and all that sort of stuff. Now we were with videotape, we couldn't shoot in the field yet, but in the studio we converted it, and we played that on the air. Then we moved to smaller tape. And that allowed portable tape recorders, or video tape recorders, to be used in the field. So we were not going directly to tape instead of having to convert it to tape in the studio. And now we're down to, then there were cassettes. The tape was built into a cassette, and that was kind of cool. And now we're down to, like I said earlier, a little tiny chip that you can record forever. Not forever. Whatever it says, how many gigabytes and all that sort of thing. measure film by feet, while we measure recording by gigabytes and bytes. The beauty of the getting away from film, going to tape first, and now these little chips, who knows what it will be in the future, is that you can go on and on and on with an interview. You can use immense amounts of gigabytes, of bytes, and not worry, and you can reuse those afterwards. So I've done interviews before where I'm interviewing somebody, I've uncovered a scam, and I'm interviewing somebody, and he doesn't know what I know, but I do know how he's operating and what he's doing. So I take my time in my interview with him. First, I'm getting his confidence that this is going to be nice and friendly interview. I just want to know about your company, blah, blah, blah. There's different techniques to use in here, but of course, in this instance, that was the approach I took. We interviewed him for 2 hours. The first half hour was pretty soft and gentle, and then we got firmer and firmer until finally he walked out and left. Said, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. Which also made great video when a guy gets up and flees out the room. So anyway, we can now go a long time. Now the downside with interviews, the downside of that is you got to review all that to get back to the station. You got to go through it and pick out those things that are the critical parts of the story that you'll use. And it takes a lot of time that way. Same thing with editing, typing. When we use typewriters, you got to be, unless you're going to use a lot of paper, which we often do that, because when you make mistakes, oh, you can kind of correct them, but when it just doesn't work, you're going to tear it out, throw a wastebasket, start all over. We were able to write scripts more quickly than we do today with computers, because with computers it's so easy to make your edits, so easy to be a perfectionist, or try to, that we sometimes spend way too much time trying to make it perfect instead of communicating a message. We get lost in the letters, the type of the keys. We think we need to get more keys. But because of the, everything was much better with, I wouldn't go back to film. In the old days when we had film, we didn't have processors. You had to process film and to develop. There was a company in Thailand called Calvin that all the stations used. So we'd go out with our little Bell & Howell 60mm silent camera, or the sound guys would go out with their big cameras and record the sound and the video. We have to rush those down to Calvin. They have to develop them, which sometimes take half hour or an hour, depending on when you get it there. And then you got to pick it up, deliver it to the station, get it on the air. Now you're no longer have to do that. It's a lot more instantaneous today than it ever was.
Do you have a particular story that you reported on that is most memorable?
Well, there are many. 35 years that you get. I think I've said this to groups before. There's so many, and this is a story that nobody remembers, but it was a story of a young boy. Gosh, how old was he? I don't know, maybe 9 or 10. He had been taken out of his home and put into they call it a retention center. Detention, and he can't leave. But they're retaining him basically until they resolve this problem with the family. So he was there. He ran away from there. And he came to the station one night about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and asked for me. I think that's unusual for a 9-year-old or 10, whatever he was. But he did because his grandma had told him to ask for me. So we met with him, and he's told us the story that he'd been taken out of his home because his mother was accused of abusing him. Until they investigated fully, he was going to be held in detention, and he was being abused there. we got a hold of him. Of course, Grandma was there. We got her how it came down. The kid had Tourette's syndrome, an illness with tics, where you suddenly blurt out, some people with Tourette's, blurt out obscenities with no control. You don't even know what you're doing. You do silly things that other people consider silly, and they're out of the ordinary, and then you're made fun of. He's got Tourette's syndrome. He's being made fun of in his school. The mom wants him moved to another school. The school says no. But if you file, the school told her, a complaint with the hotline, child abuse hotline, then he will be moved. So she did that. Turned herself in. They immediately took the kid out of the house, put him in the detention center, and they were still sorting through this whole thing. I called the juvenile authorities at the detention center. They wouldn't even admit that they had such a kid. I said, I got your kid. He's sitting right here in the conference room. We want to bring him back, but he says he's being abused there, and we want to make sure he's not abused. They wouldn't even admit that he was there. Because of all the laws governing protection of juveniles, and which is still a problem today, I think, that hasn't been resolved, that something goes on in the juvenile system that's improper, they can't talk about it even though they may be at fault. And so that whole issue needs to be, I think, resolved a little bit. Finally, we did take him back to the retention center. We got a juvenile judge to call an emergency hearing for the next morning. He did the hearing, but weren't allowed to attend because of the privacy issues. It seems silly when I know the family and the kid and all of it. It seems like there's some people just live by the rules and don't bend them a little bit when they have to, or if they're not flexible enough. So anyway, the judge immediately released the child to custody of the mom, and he got out. When that kid walked out of the juvenile center on the sidewalk where we were waiting, he just jumped up in joy, yelled hallelujah, and thanked us, and his mom, of course, did as well. So you ask her, nobody remembers seeing that story, even though it was on. It was in two parts. First part was what's the problem, and the second part was we've had this hearing, and now it's out, so it's 2 days in a row. There are many other stories that maybe the people do remember, but that's the one that meant an awful lot to me. Yeah. Sorry I took so long to explain.
Is there anything else you want people of my generation to understand about how broadcasting and news has changed over the years?
Well, there's probably so many things. Yes. How about people in the audience? Is there anything out there anybody would want me to comment on? I think we ought to wrap it up.
Do you wish you could start over again and be young and have your career over again?
Do I wish I could do this all over again?
Yeah, all today.
The business has changed. I got out. When I got in, as I indicated earlier, the stations were just learning that they could make money and growing their news departments. I got out at a time when they were reducing the size of numbers of employees, salaries were going down, and so forth, for reasons we discussed. I don't want to get back into it. For a variety of reasons, one, salaries aren't as great. Now, they still are for some people, for sure. You can still make a great living in that business, no doubt. The workloads are a lot greater. I think this whole business of editorializing with your inflection, with your selection of words that I see all the time, with the speed of your delivery, with the eyebrows that go up in delivery, those kinds of things I don't like, and I couldn't do it. And unless I was there at a time when I could spend 2 months or more researching, investigating a subject before I'd ever put it on the air. That's rare today that anybody's given that amount of time to do that. So I took an early retirement when the station was looking to save some money, I suppose, and lay a bunch of people off. And it was a very appropriate time for me. And I'm glad I did, because the new regime that came in afterwards started this change that I don't like. I would not have survived, I don't think, because of the demands, the limitations put on investigative reports. There's still some very good work being done. It's just you got to look a little harder for it, I think. Another thought I've got, there's a lot of people that talk about the print media dying, and it is. Will it die? Will it be gone? Will it be dead? No, I don't think so. Our reliance on it is less as public. That's a shame. If the Kansas City Star or these other major metropolitan dailies go out of business, I don't know what the TVs and radio stations are going to talk about, because that's where the news is generated, from the newspaper, because they have the largest staffs, because they spend time on beats where somebody is assigned to City Hall, or whatever the issue, or the federal courthouse. Without that, we're not going to learn stuff, I don't think, like we are today. The information is not going to be as available today as it used to be. So I would hate to see the newspaper, the daily newspaper business, go away. I think, although their staffs are considerably smaller today than they used to be, their salaries are down, their circulations are down, advertising revenue is down, it's still, in my opinion, the best source of news in town. And if you listen to the radio station the next morning after the newspaper comes out, or in this case, it's on the website already, so it's the day before, which is amazing to me. All of those stories, or the key stories, are being regurgitated by the talk show people and the radios. And then that evening on the TV, you'll see that story regurgitated, except with video. If it doesn't have video, you probably won't see it on TV, or it won't be on TV. Video drives that business as it should. Wire fires, and murders, and that sort of thing on every newscast, they're visual, they're easy. Quick murder. With a murder, all that's being done in many cases, most cases, is you go stick a microphone to the cop, to the policeman, get his statement about what happened, stick the mic in the face of the victim or the victim's relatives, and get a statement from them, you're done. You got the visual. And maybe the murder scene. Case of a fire, talk to the fire chief, talk to the family, talk to the neighbors, you're done. Quick and easy. That's the way it works, in my opinion. That's why we see so much of that on our TV news today, and less the investigative reporting.
I think there were some more questions.
How much time did you prepare each evening before you went on the air? I mean, how long did it take you to get out there and do it?
Right, how much preparation time went into a story that I would do? Most stories would take 3 or 4 days, regular stories, consumer reporting type stories. where I can talk to ahead of time the business, the consumer, and maybe a neutral party of some sort, and then decide to do the interview. Usually it's separate days. I do all that pre-interviewing one day, and then the next day go out, and if we decide to proceed with it and interview all these parties on camera, and get whatever video we can of whatever happened. So usually a couple of days. The bigger stories would be months, weeks and months. Yes. We would never immediately go out with a camera and interview people based on somebody's complaint. We would always do the research of that industry, of that product, of that both sides of it, and almost always contact the business or the government agency that's the subject before we ever go out. And then make a decision based on all that information we receive. And we check regulations and rules and laws that govern that issue, and then make a decision on whether to shoot. And that might take weeks or months. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's time for one
please,
more.
Please, one more.
One more?
Who are famous people that you encountered in your career?
Who are famous people I've encountered? Martin Luther King is right at the top. I interviewed him when he was in town. Ronald Reagan, president, with a very brief interview. Those are the top people. In the early days, we interviewed all kinds of celebrities before I ever got into consumer reporting. They'd come here for appearances at Starlight mostly. Bob Hope was another one I interviewed. Those are interviewing stars like Bob Hope. It's hard to get them out of their shtick. Mm-hmm. Their shtick, their routine. It's, you don't know when they're being serious with you. Or, you know, you're trying to ask a serious question and they throw a bar back at you. You know, it's really tough to figure them out. Yeah, politicians, it's easy. They're always thinking politics.
they have their shtick down, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Well, thank you so much. And I
you want to say our name again?
Oh, yes. Stan Kramer and Allison.
Stan Kramer and Allison Goldbach. This is May 31st, 2014.
Thank you so much. And your interview really just embodies what Generation Exchange is about, capturing these really wonderful stories in your prepared interview questions that Stan said that it's so important.